All right, we're going to dive right into the program today, just because we want to give everybody plenty of time to really talk. I don't know about most of you, but I have been extremely excited about today and really couldn't wait for today to really lift up and recognize all those great folks in law enforcement that really protect and look over us every day. With all the things that we've got going on in the world today, it's just, I tell you, I think about them and pray for them every day, which I know all of us in this community do. And it's just really a really great opportunity and honor for us to hold them up and recognize them for the unbelievable work that they do each day. Before we get started, I want to recognize a few of our elected officials that are here today to also really show their support for the great, great folks of our law enforcement. First, State Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen is here. We do want to appreciate and welcome him. Thanks so much. Mayor Sarah Carlson is here, and she's going to say a couple words in a few minutes as well. And then from our city council, we have Todd Jensen, Bob Kuhlman, and Owen Miller here today. So thank them as well. County Commissioner, sorry about that. I lumped them all together there. Yeah, want to make that clear, right? Yeah. Okay, so we really appreciate all of them. Now, what I would like to do is if we could have anybody at all that is working in law enforcement in our county, in our city, in our area at all, if you could please stand up so that we could recognize you here as we get started. This day is about you, and we just really, boy, from the bottom of our hearts, just thank you so, so much. We're so pleased to have the speaker that we have today, Bob Welsh, to come help us to recognize these great folks, these great leaders that we have amidst us that do absolutely keep us safe every day. You know, it's easy to take that for granted in the communities in which we live here in Douglas County, and in Alexandria, but it would not happen without these fine folks. So that we just really, really, really thank you so much. We'd like to first turn this over to Sarah Carlson, Mayor Carlson, to allow her to say a few words as well.
There we go. All right, thank you. Well, today is one of my favorite days that I get to come and address people. I have a lot of things that I speak at, but this is one of my favorites because I am very, very proud of our Alexandria Police Department. They are probably my favorite department. I hope there's no other departments here in Alexandria. But they are my absolute favorite. I'm proud of them. They do a great job. And I will get to the other departments in just a minute, or the other law enforcement areas in just a minute, Troy. Hang on. But I'm very proud of our Alexandria Police Department. Our chief is now the head of not just a state, but a national group. He was elected chairman, and I had to write this down. Chairman of the Criminal Justice Information Systems Advisory Policy Board to the FBI. And that's a pretty big deal because that's national. He calls it the CJISAPB, and so that's why I had to stop and say, what does that mean? And he's the chairman. So Little Alexandria is pretty well represented. We have a captain, Scott Kent, who will leave us in... Look at Scott, you get an applause and they don't even know why yet. He's going to go to the FBI Academy in October. And that's a pretty big deal too. So we have a well-trained force that is second to none in the nation, not just the state. We are really well trained. And I'm going to piggyback on something that our chief wrote in the No article in the Echo Press this week about partnerships. Because I went to the county fair last night, and I ran into Troy Wolverson, and I said, "How you doing, Troy? What's going on?" And I realized that it's all about partnerships. He works with us in the county. He works side by side with us. It's not all about APD. It's all about what happens in the county, and we can't legislate what happens when a brown and a blue are called on some scene together. They automatically know that they're working together and they are one and the same. I can't, as mayor, go to the county board and say, "Hey, let's all decide we're working together." Those partnerships are innate. Those guys are friends and they know it. It's a partnership that is just there. And that's really important, and that starts at the ground level. And that's so important. They don't care what color their uniform is when they're breaking down a door or working with some sort of crime. And there's nothing I can do about that in any ordinance or resolution. And so it's great that Troy is as great a man as he is, and the chief is as great a man as he is, and all the men and women in our departments are partners in that. And then we step that up a level and we look at where we are today, all of us filling this room saying, "Here we are supporting you," because in this nation at this time, we don't all have that, as we well know. It is not an easy time to be a police officer, and the support that we are showing today and those partnerships are really, really important. So it's a great thing that this city, this region, brown or blue or whatever color, it doesn't matter. We are all partners, and we need to keep that going. So we need to work together and continue working together. So whenever you see officer or a fire department person or an ambulance driver or a highway patrolman, I don't know that you want to wave at them because they might think you're flagging them down, and you probably don't want to do that. But smile at them, go up and shake their hands and thank them for the work they do, because it is not easy in this climate to be an officer, and we want to keep the good ones that we have here. So make sure you say thank you, and today is a good example of that. So thank you, and thank them.
Amen to that. All right, I am really, really excited again to introduce to you Mr. Bob Welsh. Bob was here about a year and a half ago for this same event, and I think everybody found that just a really, really, really inspiring speaker. Bob spent about 3 years in the United States Navy serving our country, and after that, he spent 29 years with his feet on the street as an Ohio State state trooper. And so he has been in the mix. He understands law enforcement in a big way. Since he retired from law enforcement, he now goes out and speaks all over the country on different subjects and on leadership, and really also just like this, to lift up law enforcement and to help them know how much they are appreciated every step of the day. So please join me in welcoming back to Alexandria, Bob Welsh.
Thank you, Mark. Can everybody hear me back there? You know, one time I talked for about 10 minutes, and some guy in the back says, "I can't hear a word you're saying back here." And before I had a chance to respond, some guy up front said, "Well, I can. I'll be glad to trade places with you." So before you get swapping seats, I want to make sure you can hear. And I didn't know how much power and authority Reverend Rice has had till I got here this morning, and I said, boy, it's a beautiful day, and he said, thank you. Yeah. I want to thank Sarah, the members of the Unity Foundation, for inviting me to speak back, to have me come back a second time. That means a lot. The people here are just wonderful. Went out with the Paul Andersons last night, and Captain Scott and Brad, the deputy, and their wives, and Paul's wife Mary was there and played the piano for us and looked at his antique things. It was absolutely terrific. I spoke at Springfield, Illinois, a couple years ago. I left there and I was heading back to Ohio, and I passed a sign along the road, and it kind of hit me like a lightning bolt when I passed it. And I'm a storyteller. I thought I'm going to make a story on that. Now, people ask me, they say, are all your stories true? All my stories are true stories, and some of them actually happened. So, but for law enforcement, let me tell you, it stood along the interstate, solitary sign. It wasn't for an exit lane or place to fuel or dine. It was not for information such as speed or legal load. But volumes could be written from that sign along the road. It merely bore a couple words, a title and a name. Was not a founding father or someone of wealth or fame, but I had cause to meditate on what they'd written down. This highway's dedicated to State Trooper Richard Brown. I never knew or met the man. Did he have kids or wife? Was it a drunk, high-speed chase or gun that took his life? Now, was the morning, afternoon, or midnight shift his last? Was he out here all by himself when things got ugly fast? I'll never second-guess the men or women we might lose, because I have walked for 30 years inside a trooper's shoes. You stop a car at 2 a.m., looks like they're making plans. The license tags are out of state. You can't see all their hands. Your flashlight darts around the car. There's dryness in your mouth. You rest your hand upon your gun in case things start going south. You might relive this scene tonight a dozen times, and yet you know full well a firearm is not your greatest threat. The traffic speeding down the road just inches from your spine is much more apt to get your name upon that highway sign. You'll risk your life to reach a crash with people trapped inside. A hairpin curve, an icy patch could be your final ride. And every day you went to work, your family never knew if this would be that dreaded shift you wouldn't make it through. So God watch o'er the families of our troops who met their fate, whose names are printed on the signs along the interstate. And what that tells us is, you know, we're comrades, like comrades in arms, all of us. When we lose a brother or sister officer, that family is still part of our organization. They're still part of your department. Don't forget that family. Don't let them drift away. For those of you in law enforcement here, you know you applied for a position. You were accepted. You ran. You climbed, you fought, you shot, you tested, and you finally qualified, got a job as to wear the badge of your department as a law enforcement officer. And every day you go to work, you put on a distinctive uniform, shiny badge, a gun, handcuffs dangling your side. You are identifiable. Two blocks away, somebody can pick you there as a police officer. And you drive a car that has more bling than the Good Humor Ice Cream Man, people can pick it out. And with what's going on today in the United States, still at this point, you don't hide. You're right out there in public view where knowing that psychos, radical terrorists, religious or political zealots, criminals, assassins, or people that just don't like police officers might want to shoot you. No, you don't hide. When shots rang out in Dallas, where the police officers were controlling a crowd of protesters, a demonstration, the police officers ran to the sound of gunfire to protect the citizens. Five of those officers did not go home that night. When a cashier in a department store doesn't have customers, oh, they mill around, straighten up things, clean their fingernails. When a lady in a beauty salon doesn't have anybody, any customers in there, she reads Glamour magazine or talks to a friend on the phone. When the barber shop's empty, the barber grabs a newspaper and sits in the chair himself and reads the paper. What do you do as a police officer when you're not on a call? Go sit and take a nap? No, you are continually working to help the public. Either you're looking for criminals, you're looking for that car that's got a license plate missing, a headlight out, you're looking for somebody that's suspicious walking back and forth past a jewelry store looking in. You're continually going, your mind's going, you're looking for something to do, you're staying busy and you're staying out in the public. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I want you to think, how many of you in here have ever climbed the ladder to take a lady's cat off a porch roof or out of a tree? How many of you have ever pulled somebody from a submerged vehicle or a vehicle that was on fire? I would like for you to go back and pull your job description out, where it tells you what you are obligated to do. Show me in there where it says you're obligated to jump into a cold, flooded stream, swim out, break a window out of a car, go in there underwater, pull somebody out and save them. Where does it say you're obligated to crawl into a burning motor vehicle and pull somebody out and administer CPR? You won't find it in there anywhere. You do it because you're not normal. You're special. Yeah, you're special. Just like retired Marine Corps Colonel Dave Grossman, psychologist, said, he coined the phrase that there are three entities in this world: the sheep and the wolves, and in between them are the sheepdogs. And that's what law enforcement is, the sheepdogs who protect the sheep daily, and they are vastly outnumbered by the wolves. I know we see a law enforcement officer in here, but there are a lot of criminals out there. I retired 21 years ago, but I still feel my chest swell with pride when I read in the paper here in the news of a police officer doing some heroic deed or cracking some uncrackable case. I still get a knot in the pit of my stomach anytime I hear of a police officer who has paid the ultimate price and given their life in the line of duty. So today is kind of an appreciation luncheon for law enforcement, but I don't want to dwell on the bad things. So I'll tell you some stories and we'll have a little humor. People just call me the storyteller. Where I live in southern Ohio, I hadn't lived there all my life, so a lot of people don't know me. They'll see me walking down the street and say, "Hey, storyteller," and they don't remember my name. Matter of fact, one guy came up and he said, "Hey, buddy," he says, "anybody ever tell you you look like that storyteller?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "That's happened." He said, "Boy, don't that make you mad?" So, I volunteer time and talk at some nursing homes. As a matter of fact, are there some people here from one of the nursing homes? I was thinking, okay, glad to have you aboard. I talk and you know, they'll bring the residents up, and I made a mistake calling them inmates one time. I don't know what I was thinking about the resident, and they would always wheel this one lady right up close front, and she was just excited when I'd tell stories. But you know, sometimes as they get older, their mind doesn't work as well. But she wasn't there one day when I went, and so afterwards I asked one of the gals there. I said, that little old lady in the wheelchair that's always up front here. I said, did she pass? Oh, no. She'd twisted her hip, and she's in a recliner chair in her room. The doctor told her just to stay in that for a few days, and she'd probably be all right. But you could probably go back and say, so I went back. I thought, well, maybe I'll tell her a story. And I went in the room, and she sat there and just kind of looked at me, and I thought, well, maybe she doesn't recognize me. I says, ma'am, do you know who I am? Oh, no, honey, but I'm sure if you go to the front desk, they'll be able to tell you. So people don't always remember your name at I live in southeastern Ohio now. I retired in 95. My wife was battling cancer. I knew she probably didn't have a long time, and I just wanted to find, I drug her all over the state following me, you know, with police work, and I wanted to find a beautiful place. So I found a farm down in southeastern Ohio in the hills, and we moved down there, and it's right on the border of West Virginia. I mean, the only thing that protects us from West Virginia is the Ohio River runs through there. They're different in West Virginia. Yeah. I think the toothbrush was invented in West Virginia. Had it been invented anywhere else, they'd have called it the teeth brush. I'm serious. I was talking to a deputy. I was talking to a deputy from over there, and we got to talk about solving crimes, and he says, it's a lot rougher solving crimes over here than it is in Ohio. And I says, why is that? He says, well, the DNA is all the same, and we don't have any dental records. So, I was asked to speak at a Chamber of Commerce down Elkins, West Virginia, and newspaper called, and they said, well, we understand you're going to speak down here for the Chamber of Commerce. I said, yes, I'll be down there a couple weeks talking. They said, well, can we put an article in the paper about it? I said, well, sure. So I talked to them quite a while and told them some, you know, how the stories I tell and jokes and things. And I said, now, ma'am, I'd appreciate if you did not print these stories or jokes, because, you know, kind of ruin it for the talks. You know, she says, oh, no, I won't. So a week later, the paper comes out, and it said, Bob Welsh will be speaking for the Elkins Chamber of Commerce. He'll be telling stories and jokes we can't print in the paper. Yeah. Yeah, they think different. In Wheeling, there was a sign they put up in the post office, man wanted for murder. Three guys come in and applied. Yeah. But that's not where I was born, raised. It's not where I learned storytelling. I learned storytelling from the time I was a kid. My father ran a hardware store. It was back then, it was called a Moore's store. And on Saturdays, when I didn't have school, I would go up to the store in the morning and sit behind the counter, and people would come into town to shop. And, you know, there's an old joke, hungrier than a rat in a hardware store. A hardware store sold everything back then except food. There was no Dick's Sporting Good, Gander Mountain Bass Pro, Cabela's. None of those existed. There was no Kmart, Walmart, O'Reilly's Auto, Napa Auto Zone. None of those existed. If you need the car battery, you went to a hardware store. Fishing pole, hunting license, shotgun shells, can of paint. muffler. You went to the hardware store. So on Saturday mornings, these guys would come in. Dad had an old gas stove that sat right behind the counter, and he'd have it fired up, and they'd tell stories and spin yarns. And I, of course, as a kid, you believe everything they say. I remember Frank Trano, a little bitty Italian, looked like he was sawed off at the pockets. And I tell you, he was so short, his feet showed up on his driver's license photo. Yeah. And Ed Kessler was just the opposite. He was a long, lanky farmer, always wore bib overalls and gum boots. And, well, you know, as a kid, you look up, it looks like he could hunt geese with a rake. And Elmo Reynolds was the best. Elmo was a salesman. I'm not sure what Elmo sold, but Elmo was slicker and calf slobber. I mean, it didn't. One time sold a milking machine there to a farmer who only had one cow, and he took the cow in on trade. Yeah, I remember my dad said, son, don't buy anything from Elmo. He says he's got more moves than a chicken on X-Lax, and he'll take your money. So, but these guys, most of them, were World War II veterans. And they had something that some of our youth today need more of, and that was values. And I remember seeing these men also at church when I go to church on Sunday. And they consummated a deal with a handshake, not a 3-page contract and 2 attorneys. So I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the values I picked up through my life, and values I saw in people I admired and respected, especially leaders, and try to emphasize them through some stories. The first value is I have to have God in prayer in my life. Yeah, you know, there may be some people go through life without it. I don't know. I lost a wife of 36 years. I lost a grandson. I have a wonderful lady with me here who lost a husband and a grandson. I don't know how either of us would have got through that without prayer. You don't spend 29 years as a state trooper or whatever tenure you've got as a police officer without running into some times that require prayer. When I come on the highway patrol, 1965, in any of our rural counties, these words did not exist. 911, E-Squad, paramedic, CPR, we called it artificial respiration. Anybody remember that? Yeah, none of those existed. And when there was a bad accident, they called the highway patrol and they'd send a trooper out. Then the next person to show up would be the funeral director, because he had a hearse. He had a vehicle big enough to throw people in to haul them off to the hospital. And there were no paramedics showing up. I remember getting to the scene of an accident one time and people laying, dying, people dead and whatnot, and I jump out with a first aid kit that's no bigger than a woman's purse, and I hear somebody say, oh, thank God the patrol's here. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Because no paramedics, no E-Squad was going to show up, and I'm waiting for a funeral home, I have held people that I've pulled out of vehicles, and I can feel crushed bones, and there's blood trickling out of their ear, and they're staring at me like they want help. And I've held them in my arms, and they're dying. And I know they're dying, and I'm sure they know they're dying. The highway patrol taught me what to do if somebody had a bad cut and put a tourniquet on it and direct pressure, if they had a broken bone to try to stabilize it. But they never told me what to do when somebody was dying in my arms. I have prayed with and for people who died in my arms. The day people would look at that and they'll say, well, that's not politically correct. You can't be a state trooper. You can't mix state along with the civilian population and church and praying. Well, if I was wrong, then my grandparents were wrong. My parents were wrong. The teachers in our schools, the ministers, the priests in my community, they were all wrong. And I don't believe they were. So don't ever, ever lose the faith of having God in prayer in your life. About 30 years ago, maybe, I read an article in a magazine, and I was so intrigued with it, I said, I have to see and touch this. It was an article about a carpenter's masterpiece they said was built strictly because of prayer, and it was a miracle. I drove to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to view a staircase. There was a chapel built, and to get up to the choir, the contractors nailed a ladder. But nuns were going to be the choir. And nuns says, no, we can't climb that ladder in our habits and whatnot, and we need a stairway. They said, well, it's too late because there's not enough room here to put one in. So I drove about 1,700 miles out to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to view and touch this work of art to put a story together. I call Prayers and Stairs. The little town is Santa Fe out in New Mexico. The story dates to well beyond 100 years ago, involves some nuns, a carpenter, and kind of magic twist. A chapel with a major flaw the architects had missed. The chapel's work is near complete when tension starts to grow. The plans neglected stairs to reach the loft from down below. Two remedies the nuns were told, and one they'd have to choose: tear out and lower the choir loft, or take out many pews. Now, mason work or carpentry was not a nun's forte, so they relied on God to help and all began to pray. They humbly asked the Lord to let St. Joseph give them aid, the patron saint of carpenters. For 9 straight days they prayed. An old man knocked upon their door, no record of his name. The nuns had not seen him before, knew from where he came, said he was a carpenter, assured them he was skilled, and if they left him to himself, their stairway he would build. Could this man somehow overcome the architectural flaw with just a hammer in his hand, a T-square and a saw? The only other thing observed from what the nuns have said, a little toolbox strapped upon the donkey that he led. But they agreed to leave him be, indulging in his trade, and as the weeks turned into months, they waited. And they prayed. And then one day the man emerged and said the job was done, but all they saw were those few tools he'd brought when he'd begun. Now apprehension filled their minds about his expertise, but in the chapel they observed a stunning masterpiece. The staircase didn't climb the wall or slant like you'd assume. It spiraled up in flowing grace and took up little room. Precision placement of each step. They numbered 33 and twisted round in 2 full turns in perfect symmetry. 'Twas wooden pegs the old man used his hammer to impale, because throughout the spiral stair there's not a single nail. The feature most remarkable that carpenters extol, the staircase can support itself. It has no center pole. Some architects who viewed the stairs were skeptically amused. They said it would come crashing down the first time it was used. But architects have come and gone, dispelling all their fears. The staircase stood the test of time when used 100 years. That it would not hold someone's weight, like many experts said, was proven wrong when people stood on every single tread. The greatest mystery of the stairs, the old man engineered, involves his true identity. He simply disappeared. The nuns went out to pay the man, but he was not around. No trace of donkey, man, or tools has ever since been found. They checked down at the lumber yard, but caught them unawares. They had no knowledge of the wood or man who built the stairs. Examination of the wood by experts soon would show was not a type they'd seen before or from New Mexico. I know who built the spiral stairs, we've heard some people claim. But it's sure strange those nuns were there yet never got his name. Their detailed records listed all construction and repairs, but nowhere in their ledger is an entry for the stairs. We may not ever know for sure who built the spiral stairs, but never underestimate the awesome power of prayers. Thank you. I was speaking for a church down in Georgia, and there was a little boy at the back of church, and the preacher came in. The boy was looking at a plaque that was on the wall, and the preacher, he patted him in the head, and he said, "Son," he says, "I admire you for taking a moment to acknowledge those names up there." He says, "Those are names of men from our congregation who died in service." Little boy says, "Which one, the 9 o'clock or the 11:30? Yeah, sometimes, though, you probably never got accused of talking too long. We had a preacher that did one time. He talked so long, a guy actually died in church. And the squad carried out 3 guys before they got the right one. Yeah. If God answers your prayers, well, He answers all of them. Sometimes He answers no, but He answers all our prayers. But if He answers them the way you want, thank Him. You know, sometimes we have a tendency to forget all about God once our prayers are answered. Like the guy that was going for the job interview, and he had to be there at 2 o'clock, and it's about 10 till 2. He's running a little late, and he gets there. The parking lot's full. You couldn't have got a bicycle in it. And he says, "Oh, I'm going to have to park a couple blocks away and run back. I'm going to be late. I'm not going to make it. I won't get the job." He says, "God, give me a place right up near the door where I can get in." He says, "I'll go to church Sunday. I'll put $50 in the collection plate." And about that time, a car pulls right out from in front of the front door. He says, "Never mind, God, I found one." Yeah, so say thanks when your prayers are answered. Several years ago, about 11 o'clock at night, I got a phone call with a deep southern accent. "Is this Bob Welsh?" I said, "Yes, sir, it is." "Well, I'm with the North Carolina Highway Patrol, and we'd want you to write us a poem." I said, "You want me to write a poem for him?" "Yes, sir. We'd like to have it by tomorrow if you could." I said, "Well," he said, "well, they wanted a poem. They have a caisson unit. In World War I, they transported munitions and supplies to the lines on a flat four-wheeled wagon pulled by horses. Later on, they transported the bodies of the fallen warriors to their final rest on that wagon. You've seen it in Arlington Cemetery, pulled by 4 horses. 3 have riders, 1 is riderless, and boots are placed in the stirrups. It's got a saddle. Stirrups facing backwards, indicating this warrior will never have to do earthly battle again. He says, "We want you to write us a poem. We have a caisson unit, and we want to use it at the funeral of a trooper." Well, I told him there's no way I can do it by tomorrow, but I'll think about it. Well, I obviously didn't go to bed that night, and got up and sat downstairs, made a pot of coffee, and thought. I come up with "Ode to a Trooper." Now, I want you to visualize the caisson taking an officer to their final rest. A solemn crowd in mourning views the caisson pass their way. A funeral dirge of clicking hooves. A trooper died today. He wasn't of the corporate world, no shingle for his name. He sought no notoriety, prestige, or wealth or fame. But what a mark this trooper left. No one will ever know. Investments only God could list in his portfolio. How many tires did he change at night on 4-lane roads in pouring rain where semi-trucks scream by with heavy loads? How many injured has he held in traffic wrecks at night, who know they're dying far from home while overcome with fright? But then their panic fades away and calmness takes its place. Their final view upon this earth, a trooper's caring face. How many people threatened him or tried to take his gun? How could he bravely stand his ground when normal men would run? How many children still recall him speaking at their school, where they learned speed and alcohol and drugs was not so cool? Most of us will never know, and troopers seldom tell, of house calls made at 2 a.m. where mothers shriek and yell. He never brought misery home, a chase, a wreck, a threat. Yeah, troopers keep a lot inside they never will forget. But he has left a legacy that monarchs can't transcend. It's how a son describes his dad when talking with a friend. So as the caisson marches past, just bow your head and pray. The world has lost a warrior. A trooper died today. A riderless yet saddled horse with boots placed in reverse, this trooper bids a farewell to our worldly universe. The caisson wheels are silent now. The horse's hooves sedate. 'Cause there's a trooper riding tall through heaven's golden gate. Another critical value, I think, is treating others with dignity and respect. I think sometimes the size of a department and the proximity of backup can let you realize that, well, you don't have to stand out here all night and put up with this guy's mouth, because I got people can be here in a minute. But I worked a couple different counties that I would be the only law enforcement officer awake at 2 in the morning. The sheriff's department was small, might not have a midnight shift. The police department in the county seat didn't have anybody working. And I'm by myself. So when I stop somebody and they start giving me a lot of mouth, you know, it'd be easier for me just to kind of take my time and work with them rather than get in a fight with them right there immediately. And, you know, who knows, I might lose. So I learned that sometimes if you don't steal a person's dignity. You know, I bring a guy in to run a breathalyzer and I want him to sit here, it's not right there, sit down. No, sir, I got to get some things ready. Mind having a seat here while I get this fixed up? You don't steal his dignity. Don't tell him. And I had a guy step out one time and he just stood there and he said, "Buddy, I could kick your butt." I says, "Well, that's nothing." I said, "My wife can do that. You get your driver's license on you?" Yeah. But you all know, you've got a switch here on your side. You can't lose track. You got that switch. And the minute somebody does pull a gun or puts a hand on you or assaults you, you flip that into the survival mode. And then it's hair, teeth, and eyeballs all over the highway because you're going home tonight. But in the meantime, you can, you know, and I've had people stand there like they want to fight, you know, and while I'm talking to them, I'm saying, "Look, sir, you know, we're going to have to go in, you know, this is," and I'm taking the things out of my pocket and taking my badge off. I'm preparing for war. And eventually they'll, "Okay, well, you've been nice to me, maybe I will." So you, like I said, when you're all alone and you have no backup, sometimes you learn that. But as a rule, do your best to treat people with dignity and respect. I'm going to tell you a kind of longer story here, but it has to do with leadership. It has to do with treating people with dignity and respect and what it does, what the outcome could be. In 1963, there was a fella named Ed Lorenz, and he attended the New York Academy of Science, and he proposed a hypothesis that if a butterfly flaps its wings, it causes molecules of air to move. Those molecules affect other molecules, which affect others, that could eventually cause a hurricane on the other side of the world. Well, Ed dusted himself off after they threw him out of the New York Academy of Science. And for 30 years, that was scoffed at as sci-fi stuff. There were some movies on it. In 1993, 30 years later, some scientists from different parts of the world got together and they said, "You know, he's right." And they actually coined it, dubbed it a law, like the law of gravity, the law of centrifugal force, the law of sensitive dependence upon initial conditions. Something that happens now can have a far-reaching effect later on. I visited the Battle of Gettysburg and saw where one colonel there, the only colonel at Gettysburg, did not have a West Point pedigree. Colonel Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain had to defend one area called Little Round Top. And as I studied this, I thought, boy, this is exactly the butterfly effect. He is made colonel for the 20th Maine Regiment, and then there were a bunch of mutineers who had a two-year enlistment, and it was up, but the Army said, we're not going to let you go because we got a lot of big fighting to do. We can't let you out right now. And they said, well, wait, our enlistment's up, and we're not going to fight. So they didn't feed them, and they took their guns, and they said, well, we'll dump them on this young colonel. Let him take care of them. Let him shoot them if they don't work. So I simply call this Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. No crystal ball foretells our woes or measures the extreme, but we can know through leadership the mettle of our team. In May of 1863, the future wasn't clear. The Civil War had moved into its third and bloody year. One regiment of volunteers, the 20th of Maine, had men believing they had lost, that fighting was in vain. They'd seen their numbers dwindle down, had watched their comrades die. Their hope was gone, morale was low, desertions running high. And comes a man named Chamberlain, no West Point pedigree, promoted to a colonel's rank. His age was 33. In charge of this Maine infantry, he suddenly was thrust. He had to work to gain respect, but most of all their trust. But then he finds he's saddled with a fate he never planned. 120 mutineers were dumped on his command. His orders were to make them work, shoot any man who runs. For 3 days' march, they'd not been fed and stripped of all their guns. Now Chamberlain must take the men, no leeway to refuse. Deciding how to deal with them left options he could choose. He let them choose a man to air their gripes and discontent. Never once did interrupt as through a list he went. He gathered all the mutineers, addressed them man to man. He said, I understand your plight and will do what I can. But nothing can be done today. We've got no time to spare. We're marching now to Gettysburg. The whole Reb Army's there. It's not for land, for loot or fame or king we're fighting for. We're freeing men, and this is not like any other war. You all joined up for freedom's sake, and what you knew was right. I need you now. And there's no doubt you got the will to fight. The men were fed, their guns returned, then blended in its ranks. They vowed to fight for Chamberlain. His short response was thanks. At break of day, they start their march, a fast, relentless pace. They follow Colonel Chamberlain like foxhounds on a chase. When 16 miles from Gettysburg, they hear the cannons roar. A somberness envelops them, a chill they can't ignore. It's early evening, and they plan to march at morning light. But soon a messenger arrives. They must advance tonight. No time for rest or supper now. They quickly grabbed a bite, fell in ranks, and started off marching through the night. With just one stop to get some rest before their strength was gone, the colonel knew they'd have to reach the battlefield by dawn. Exhausted, hungry, men from Maine who never breathed a whine emerged at dawn and took their place right on the battle line. A stretch called Cemetery Ridge, the Western Union flank, must be defended to the man as rebel clash with Yank. Then Little Round Top forms a knoll right on the southern end, and it is here that Chamberlain must at all costs defend. He knows if the Confederates can overrun the hill, they'll swarm behind the Union lines and slaughter men at will. Strategically, he spots his men atop the rocky knoll. It's introspective times like this men pray and search their soul. The 15th Regiment below of hardened rebel will has 700 rifles poised to overrun the hill. Then suddenly the cannons roared with muskets fired at will, unleashed a flood of rebel troops resigned to take the hill. The air is filled with rifle lead, thick smoke and sulfur smell, but men from Maine refuse to budge amidst a living hell. With steady nerve and careful aim, they thwarted the attack, and brutal fighting ebbed away with rebels falling back. The 15th Alabama would attack and re-attack, but couldn't break the Union line or drive the Yankees back. By afternoon, the fifth attack was met and then repelled, and military strategists cannot believe they held. These men had been demoralized and harbored losing fears. Then forced among their dwindled ranks were all these mutineers. They'd marched all night, fought all day, never had a meal, outnumbered now with many dead. Where did they find their zeal? There's little doubt their tough resolve and firm, tenacious grip came straight from Colonel Chamberlain's dynamic leadership. He spent the day directing men, and after each attack would reposition needed troops to seal up any crack. With bitter fighting through the day, supplies of ammo shrank. And now he sensed the next attack would breach his southern flank. Men turned and looked at Chamberlain, their ammunition gone. Expression saying, "Tell us, sir, how do we carry on?" He knew that armies in the past, when pushed or driven back, had overturned a certain loss by opting to attack. Most orders given in a war our history soon forgets, but we'll remember Chamberlain, who yelled, "Fix bayonets." One simple click transformed the gun from rifle into lance. The sudden shock of charging steel would be their only chance. Late afternoon, about 6:30, as rebels caught their breath, the line of blue charged down the hill to rout or meet their death. The screaming charge of flashing steel caught rebels by surprise. Confusion filled the southern ranks. No time to organize. The Union had turned the tide against the Southern Corps, with twice their number taken back as prisoners of war. One final day of fighting yet on Pennsylvania's dirt, where 50,000 brave young men lay dead or badly hurt. So all remember Gettysburg, its test of strength and will, and men who fought with Chamberlain on Little Round Top Hill. Now I want you to think about what I just started this with when I talked about the butterfly effect. Had Chamberlain not held Little Round Top and the Confederate Army got behind, they would have been behind Meade's line. They would have slaughtered the Union soldiers, and the South would have won the Battle of Gettysburg. Had they won the Battle of Gettysburg, historians tell us they would have won the Civil War. Had the South won the Civil War, it's easy to surmise, well, we'd just be north and south along the Mason-Dixon line, but military strategists tell us no, that would not have happened. We would have been 9 to 13 different countries on this United States we have now. It would not be the same. We'd be just like Europe. And in 1939, 40, 41, when Hitler started his march across Europe, eating up Poland, Czechoslovakia, Italy, France, fighting Russia and England, declaring war in the United States, and Hirohito started his march at the same time across the Pacific, eating up Guam, Wake, Midway, Okinawa, Corregidor, Pearl Harbor. There would not have been a nation on the face of this planet big enough, strong enough, populous enough, wealthy enough, with a strong enough military to fight two wars at the same time, halfway around the world from each other, and win both of them. That would not have been possible had it not been for one decision. Two words, fix bayonets. And why did the men follow him charging downhill into an army with loaded guns with an empty weapon? Because they trusted him. And they trusted him because he'd built confidence. He'd treated them with dignity and respect. So that's what the butterfly effect is, and that's what we're talking about in law enforcement. Treat people with dignity and respect, and it can come back to help you. You will make thousands of contacts in your career, and you'll be lucky to remember 1% of them. But every single person you have contact with is going to remember you. Anybody in here who has ever had contact or been stopped by a police officer remembers that contact. You remember you first saw the lights flashing. You remember how he or she approached your car, what they said. You'll remember that the rest of your life. It's just another stop in the life of a police officer. But you treat each person with dignity and respect, and they'll remember that. And you never quit. You never give up. How am I doing on time? Am I all right? I'm over? I got 1 minute. Oh, Jiminy Christmas. No, what a shame. 1 minute. Then I'll just tell you about never giving up. I'll tell you about when I first got married. We were traveling through Pennsylvania, and we came to a little town. And I says, Lancaster. And my wife says, no, it's Lancaster. I said, well, it's Lancaster. She says, no, it's Lancaster. Well, she wouldn't give it up. And so we had to stop and get a bite to eat and went in this little place to get something to eat. And of course, we're ordering. She won't let it drop. She asked the guy behind her. She says, sir, my husband's a little slow, doesn't understand me. She says, would you pronounce the name of this place slowly and distinctly so he's got the pronunciation correct? He said, yes, ma'am. Burger King. Yeah. So that's it. Okay, well, I got just end it with who here can remember? I know Vince and Paul can. Remember somebody taking coffee, pouring it in their saucer and drinking it. Because the coffee was hotter back then. It didn't drip through the grounds under a warming plate. So that's what I'd like to end with. I never made a fortune, probably too late now. I don't worry about that much. I'm happy anyhow. As I travel through life's journey, I'm reaping better than I sowed. I'm drinking from my saucer because my cup is overflowed. I ain't got a lot of riches. Sometimes the going's rough. I got a lady who loves me, and that makes me rich enough. So I thank God for his blessings, the mercies he's bestowed. I'm drinking from my saucer because my cup is overflowed. Sure, I remember when times went wrong, my faith got a little thin. But all at once that dark cloud broke and the sun peeked through again. So Lord, help me to never gripe about the tough rows I've hoed. I'm drinking from my saucer because my cup is overflowed. And if he gives me the strength and courage when the road is steep and rough, I won't ask for a whole lot more. He's given me quite enough. But I hope I never get too busy to help another bear their load. Then I'll keep drinking from my saucer because my cup is overflowed. And my cup is overflowed with Sarah sending me an email and saying, Bob, would you find time to come back out and speak to us again? I'm truly honored that this law enforcement community would have me come out here and speak to you. And on behalf of Alexandria, Douglas County, the state of Minnesota, the United States, I want to give a warm applause to all the law enforcement officers we've ever met. All right.
Bob, thank you so much for blessing us with your talent, your insights. We really, really appreciate that. Just a couple things real quick before we go. I just want to give a couple more tributes to our law enforcement. Helen Keister is a resident at Canute Nelson. And she wrote this poem that's on the back of your sheet that I'd like to read to you. Thanks to our law enforcement, you're here to help when needed with never a complaint. You're dependable and comforting. You must be a group of saints. When you're called to respond, you're reacting fast and sincere, and we feel a sense of comfort whenever you appear. You help the ambulance drivers and us elderly people too. What would we do without you? You're such a special crew. May God bless you all from the Canute Nelson residents. They also have brought a number of, I don't know how many dozen cookies that they made themselves, so the folks from Canute Nelson would like for all the law enforcement people to take those cookies back to the shop, back to the office, and enjoy those. Couple other things. Thank you, Mary Anderson, for gracing us with your beautiful talents on the piano. We really appreciate that. A hand for Mary, please. And then one other thing, John Crone, who owns SignMax, has so graciously, they have printed up some banners and bumper stickers and yard signs that say, "We support law enforcement." And they've donated all of those signs, and there's a donation for each one of those if you would like one. And all that money is going to go back into our law enforcement agencies. So thank you, John, and the team at SignMax. You can get those here on your way out. You can get them at the fair. They'll be at the county fair at the county law enforcement spot there, as well as at their store if you'd like those. So everything, all those proceeds go right to our county law enforcement. So with that, one last thing I would say, you know, I get the chance, I talk about servant leadership every day. That's what I do. And I believe that God called us all to be servant leaders wherever we're at. And I can't think of a better example of servant leadership than what each of these folks have stepped into their occupation. Every day they are out there thinking about the greater good of others above and beyond themselves. And one last time, let's absolutely give it up for these amazing folks that take care of us every day. Another thing I just heard is that Bob also has some CDs if you'd like to buy those. Thank you all so much for supporting our law enforcement. Thank you for being here today. And God bless all of you as you finish out this week and the rest of the month. Thank you.